This is Resonance 104.4 FM, sorry, and you're listening to Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about science, rationalism, humanism and the progressive left. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, politics and journalism, talking about subjects as diverse as conspiracy theories, cosmology, religion, the New Age, human rights and the state of the left. Our guest today is the writer and filmmaker John Ronson, so we'll have a little more music and then Richard will introduce John. As Neil was saying, Little Atoms is Resonance FM's science and politics slot. But our guest today is neither a scientist or a politician, although his recent work, notably in The Men Who Stare at Goats, has brought those two worlds, science and politics, together, albeit at the wilder fringes. He's a writer and a documentary maker whose work has given us some memorable character portraits of people as disparate as Omar Bakri, Ian Paisley and David Icke. He was also, very briefly, the keyboard player for Frank Sidebottom. John Ronson, welcome to Resonance FM.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And I'm going to ask you a first question, which took me ages to write out.
Is it about Frank Sidebottom?
No. We'll save that for later. I've got a few sort of extraneous things I want to ask you. Now, there was a lot of the people that you write about, especially in Them, Adventures with Extremists, they all seem to share sort of paranoid conspiracy theories, the New World Order and all that. And in a recent interview I read, you refer to an escalating paranoia on both sides, particularly since September the 11th. And you speak about the extremist and the secular liberal, there being a sort of escalating paranoia. Could you expand on that a little bit for me?
Well, I noticed that when I was in Vancouver with David Icke. David Icke was going around the world saying that, you know, the global elite, members of the Bilderberg Group and the British Royal Family and so on, are all 12-foot lizards who've adopted human form, you know, child-sacrificing, blood-drinking, paedophile reptiles. Chris Christopherson, Boxcar Willie, the Queen Mother, Hillary Clinton, but not Bill Clinton. I knew about David Icke's lizard theories for a while, but I didn't kind of want to touch them because I thought it was just nuts. And there was nothing to say. But then I heard that there were all these secular liberals, members of groups like the Canadian Jewish Congress and the Anti-Defamation League and Anti-Racist Action. You know, people very much from my side of the fence.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, and people who I liked very much on a, you know, one-on-one basis. But they were all convinced when David Icke said 12-foot blood-drinking lizards, he was using code, and what he really meant was Jews. And David Icke would say, no, I really do mean lizards. And they'd say, well, that's code too. And there's kind of no winning, you know. And that's when I began to notice, you know, as the extremists were getting crazier, so were our responses towards them. And obviously all of this was pre-9/11. I mean, my adventure with David Icke was a few months before September the 11th. But obviously you notice kind of resonances of that. I hate to use these American phrases, but I can't think of another phrase, that kind of sort of symbiotic relationship between the people on our side of the fence and the people on their side of the fence, that we kind of need each other. And it spirals into nuttiness on both sides. And you obviously notice resonances of that in the post-9/11 world, do you not?
You do. And do you think that the left secular paranoia has grown really with the rise of, the rise of Bush, really. I mean, he's now got a definite elected majority as opposed to the rather dubious one he had in the first time round.
Well, I mean, we've been pushed to the fringes. When I was writing Them was a book about Clinton's essentially secular, rational administration, and the people who were resorting to conspiracy theories and, you know, paranoid, neurotic thought were the nationalists and the racists and the people who felt like twigs in the tidal wave of globalisation, and the people living up in Idaho, and so on. You know, they were the nutty people. But, you know, now we're the nutty people because, you know, we're the disenfranchised. You know, so you've got that. And the gap between us and them is narrowed hugely. I mean, you know, when I was writing them, I had to point out that conspiracy theory was at the heart of, you know, terrorism and extremism, and now we're all conspiracy theorists. I mean, you know, it's no longer a matter of, you know, I wonder whether there'll be conspiracy theories in the wake of the London bombs. It's like, you know, you get them 10 minutes later, and we all believe
indeed,
it.
Indeed, yeah.
So, and I think that's a lot to do with, you know, Bush being in power and us feeling like an oppressed minority. But it's also to do with, I think, the fact that we feel just a long way away from our leaders, which we didn't quite so much in the late 90s. You know, we felt that Tony Blair was one of us, and we felt Clinton was a good guy. And, you know, now suddenly Tony Blair feels like, you know, a million miles away, and so does George Bush.
You touched on that a little bit. Originally, when Them was published in the UK, you know, it was received as, you know, a gentle description of the extremists, and you know, you humanise them, and, you know, character studies, as Richard mentioned earlier. Then, of course, bad timing, before it can be released in America, 9/11 happens. Some of those extremists rather inconveniently fly jumbo jets into the World Trade Center.
Yeah, not great. Not great time to bring out a funny book about extremists.
So, can you talk a little about what that culture was like, what it was like to release the book in America at that time, and how it was received?
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating. Well, first I didn't think they were going to release it in America. And then they did. The first thing that happened, a couple of weeks after September the 11th, I was invited onto this show called Fresh Air with Terry Gross on National Public Radio. And they said, you're not going to believe it, Terry Gross wants to interview you. You know, she only interviews, you know, Clinton and, you know, Shimon Peres. And I thought, okay. So I went on the show, and her first question to me was, you spent a year with an Islamic fundamentalist, a colleague of Osama bin Laden's. You portrayed him as a harmless buffoon. You were wrong, weren't you? So obviously in her mind I'd become this sort of...
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and I'd become this kind of, you know, the sort of poster boy for the death of irony. I thought that my portrait of Omar Bakri was accurate. And I still do. And in fact, Channel 4 re-showed Tottenham Adhola, the film I made about him, quite recently.
Indeed.
And what was interesting, and I don't want to be too self-aggrandising, but I do think what was interesting is that it was funny then, and it's not funny now, but it doesn't make the film any worse.
There were some moments in the re-showing of it that were quite startling. You know, there was the list of people that he was going to be bringing to the Docklands Arena,
yeah.
And of course one of them was Osama bin Laden,
yeah.
on film or video or something. And I remember, I'm sure I would have. That would have, it didn't have so much effect. I mean, I was aware of Osama bin Laden, but obviously after a certain date, he was public enemy number one, and it was quite shocking to see this name just in the middle of a whole list of people.
Yeah, and, you know, most of the film was set at the Finsbury Park Mosque, and you know, as we know, I mean, you know, there's obviously a lot of problems with the new terror legislation about closing down mosques and, you know, glorifying, you know, all of that stuff. But, you know, the Finsbury Park Mosque at that time was clearly a hotbed of terrorist planning. You know, we know that Zachariah Massawi was there, the 20th hijacker, and Richard Reid, I believe, was there. And so it is kind of funny to think that we were bumbling around in a silly way, you know, at that time. Interestingly, nobody from the police ever called to us to look at the rushes.
But do you think the same about Omar now? I mean, would you still say he was bumbling, or do you think he did have a hand in Richard Reid and things like that?
It's really hard. I can't come to a conclusion about Omar. I just can't. They wanted me to, Channel 4. They wanted me to sort of come up with a conclusion. I just couldn't, because part of me thought, you know, actually, maybe he was a piece of the jigsaw puzzle.
Maybe he's cleverer than we all thought, and he actually played you quite well.
Yeah, it's quite possible.
Make him
it's quite... Not that I think... you know, even if that's true, I don't believe that he would have played me to the extent, you know, that he would have sort of acted like a silly fool in front of me, and then as soon as my back was turned, you know, turned into the sort of Machiavellian villain. You know, I don't think he would have done that. But I think it's quite possible to act in that silly way towards me and act in the same way towards Richard Reed, but with a purpose and with some influence. You know, I do think that's possible. I mean, at the end of the film, I came out with the, you know, conclusion that there was kind of nothing beneath Omar, and you know, it was, I can't remember what the phrase that I used, but something like, you know, it seemed, you know, kind of inappropriate for the government to dazzle us with shows of strength against people like Omar. But I'm not sure, you know, I think, and I don't think anybody's sure. And actually, I don't think the government necessarily were wrong to chuck Omar out, because, you know, nobody knows. I mean, there's no hard intelligence on Omar, and I think they were just being cautious. And I think within that, you know, the context of the weeks after the London bombs, it was probably right to be cautious. But I didn't say that at the end of the film. I kind of said that it just seemed, you know, Omar's world just seemed empty, which is possibly equally true.
You could be thought of as sort of not necessarily inventing, but certainly popularising this sort of the phoney style of interviewing, where you seemingly get close to the subjects to get into their confidence. But what strikes me as pretty amazing is how often you do stay in contact with them, and you do seem genuinely to really have relationships with these people. Does this make it harder to then portray them in this way? Because you are, Omar Bakri, you are portraying someone who could likely have had a hand in 9/11.
Yeah. And, you know, I never see myself necessarily in that kind of faux naive way, because, you know, I go in, you know, I think it's kind of genuine naivety, really, because you go in, yeah, being genuinely interested and curious and wanting to know more about their world. And, you know, I very rarely am sort of laughing under my hand. I mean, it hardly ever happens, because I'm just really interested to be with them.
Well, I think in the way that it's become a genre, hasn't it? There are other reporters that are doing the same thing.
I have unleashed a Pandora's box of...
What have you started?
I planted a bunch of seeds, and this vineyard of faux naivety has grown in my wake. But sometimes they suffer. I mean, it doesn't happen that often, and I'm always happiest when it doesn't happen. Like, it didn't happen with Ian Paisley. Both, you know, Sinn Féin and the Free Presbyterians really liked my film about Ian Paisley.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so Paisley and his people loved it, and, you know, the IRA loved it, so that's why.
I had one very simple question about the Paisley documentary. Did you warm to him at all?
Wasn't easy to. I can tell you a story about him. I've talked this to it before, and they cut it out. I think it's kind of, it's like an unpleasant story. It's a bit too personal, but I'll tell it.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'll tell it anyway. My wife was pregnant when I was with Ian Paisley in Africa, and you know, we'd had our sort of rocky moments, me and Paisley. But my wife filled me up in a bit of a panic, because they said that there was like a 1 in 250 chance that our son would have Down syndrome. And I, you know, I was in the kind of Yayundi Hilton, and you know, I'm sort of a bit neurotic at the best of times. So obviously I freaked out, and I thought, I need to talk to somebody about this. And immediately the person I thought I should talk to was Ian Paisley. I wanted sort of guidance and counselling from Ian Paisley, not like my best friend, the producer or the cameraman, but Ian Paisley. So I went downstairs and I found him, and I sort of approached him and said, Dr. Paisley. He said, not now. I'm kind of walked off. So, you know, so I never got to do it. But so I must have liked him, you know, to an extent. But I think sometimes you do. Sometimes they kind of do, you know, because when you're back writing it or editing it, you sort of feel as if you owe it to the story to tell your, you know, perception of the events. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it... You know, even if I'm sort of with them all the way at the time, when I've got a little bit of space, I can see what they're, you know, I can see that there's some idiosyncrasies that are worth highlighting or whatever.
You've written that you get Christmas cards from Jonathan King, for instance, and it must be difficult to keep a critical distance when you're developing that sort of relationship.
He won't. Jonathan King's a funny one, because he's really in denial about a lot of things.
Of course.
He keeps thinking that I sort of support his case. And I don't.
Which
at all.
It was quite clear from the documentary.
Yeah, that I don't. And a few times he sort of emailed me and said, you know, Roy Greenslade's written something horrible about me. Will you email him and set the record straight?
What power you have.
I know. But, see, it's a funny one, Jonathan. He'll sort of just take the bits that he wants to take from a relationship. Yeah. But, yeah, no, my wife gets a bit annoyed. I once invited a member of the Manson family to tea.
Which one?
Sandra Good. She was in London. She wanted my postcode, and I said it was at the time it was N11JX. I said N1, I said 1JX. J, I said J for John, X for what you've got carved in your forehead. She said, that's not funny.
Did she wear a hat?
No, but it's faded. I mean, she's blind now, so the X isn't quite as...
just a fortuitous looking...
Yeah, basically. So, but you do kind of forget. And actually, I tell you what's interesting is that, you know, when a kind of nutty person acts like a nut, I'm completely surprised, you know, when they sort of... And it doesn't happen very often, but I had a terrible falling out with a cult leader, and I don't like... And it's probably the only time I would use the word cult, because it's such a pejorative, loaded term. And he was just horrible towards me. And people say, well, what do you expect? He's a cult leader. Because normally they're just, you know, charming, you know, and we get on well, and I see the human side, and we connect on a human level. And it really surprises me when they kind of act a type, you know.
I was curious about the time you spent with, is it Big Jim Tucker, who is the man who's chasing the Bilderberg group all over the world and finding out more about them. And, of course, there's the much related incident with the car with the black windows that was following you. But did it occur to you later on that perhaps your own paranoia levels had been increased just by spending time with these people?
Oh, absolutely. You completely slide into their world. And I think you'd be a worse journalist if you don't. You know, if you can go in with all your scepticism and, you know, urban cosmopolitanism, you know, sort of like a suit of armour... you're not going to have a good story because you're just going to be some guy with arched eyebrows in the middle of a, you know,
smirking ironically.
Yeah, and that, you know, I hate that as much as anyone, you know. And I'm never like that. I completely slide into their world. It's luckily, you know, when I'm back and I'm writing it up and I'm sort of back home, I sort of regain a sense of perspective, but can manage to sort of honestly portray the nutty feelings I was feeling, and you know, when I was in the middle of those adventures. But Bilderberg was slightly different when I was chased with Jim Tucker, because the paranoia lasted for ages, you know, because I'd never been chased by men in dark glasses before. I couldn't say this is a bit like the time I was chased by the shadowy henchmen of the New World Order back in 83, you know, nothing like that had ever happened to me before. So that was, you know, so it took me a long time to get over that.
Well, the whole Bilderberg thing is, I think, you know, I mean, in a way, it's the crux of the book, because it's the, you know, all these different people are all talking about this, the secret rulers of the world who are controlling things in this shadowy way, and yet you managed to get to Dennis Healy, is one of the founders of the group.
Yeah, I mean, the moment I was chased by the Bilderberg group in Portugal, you know, for me is the key moment of the book, because it's the moment when any arched eyebrowness just vanishes, and I, you know, I go native, I become the people that I'm writing about. And had that not happened, yeah, I think it would have, well, it sort of changed my perspective on sort of everything, because, you know, I sort of slid completely from my world into their world. So I'm very glad it happened, even though it wasn't particularly pleasant at the time. Yeah, and then I get to Dennis Healy, who's you know, the head.
Pretty open about it. He wasn't prepared to show you his photographs. But
no. yeah, and you begin to see the Bilderberg group from their perspective, which actually doesn't seem... Well, certainly when it was formed, it doesn't seem like such a terrible idea.
And it seems like the World Trade Organization, but slightly more secretive, but certainly not...
With a touch of Freemasonry, perhaps, and in the secrecy, and probably a bit of blokiness going on, I imagine, as well.
Which is what comes out when you
Bohemian Grove, when you infiltrate Bohemian Grove and Alex Jones is there and he's going, it's so satanic, it's awful, and you're thinking,
it's
just a bunch of guys on holiday, they're doing something stupid, but it's, it's embarrassing, but...
But it's not, I mean, Alex saw the same ritual I did and went off saying, you know, that it looked like a papier-mâché effigy that was thrown into the fiery belly, but it might have been an actual child. And, you know, and I went away saying, oh, it's just a silly pageant. Actually, the thing that, you know, that I remember most of all about Bohemian Grove was how all the men, the old men in the audience, you know, we're all really into it. I felt like the only sane person in the whole Redwood Forest, you know, because Alex is going, it's satanic, it's nutty, it's, you know, it's evil. And all these old men are going, burn him, burn him, you know. So all these old men were just as into it as Alex was, in their own way.
Has Alex changed his opinion about that at all? I mean, I know he's still got his... I think you can buy the video, the footage that he shot from his website.
Dark Secrets.
So he still thinks it's some real... He hasn't at all changed his opinion on it.
Nuh-uh. And, you know, me and Alex were on Coast to Coast recently. It wasn't Art Bell, it was George and Uri, but, you know, huge, 10 million listeners, all of whom, you know, believe in this stuff. And... I remember George Nuri's question to me was, so Bohemian Grove, is it satanic or is it just evil?
did you reply?
I said that I thought that it was, you know, a kind of made up ceremony because America's a new country and you know, so they sprinkled a bit of Broadway and a bit of paganism and a sort of bit of Shakespeare. Yeah, a little bit of Satanism, and I sort of stuck it all together and came up with this ridiculous pageant, which is what I think it is. But of course, all these people are saying, "Oh, well, they let John Ronson in, you know, because, you know, he would, you know, they knew that he was, you know, was skeptical, and he would
just a patsy, that thing.
Yeah, and the, you know, all the torture and the human sacrifice goes on in the underground, you know." Buildings under our feet, beneath the owl.
In a way, that's one of the dangers of the whole of the sort of paranoid conspiracy theory world is that everything can be explained away. And there's layer after layer after layer of it.
Yeah, and you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff about me working for them, working for the New World Order, or, you know, either knowingly or unknowingly working for the New World Order.
Really, that's interesting.
Yeah. You've infiltrated Resonance FM.
My subliminal messages.
John, one of the things that's fascinated me recently is the way that some of the sort of quite mainstream things, whether it be the Church of England or the Army, for goodness sake, are starting to assimilate New Age and fringe ideas. And this particularly, as applies to the Army, was is what you write about in The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Mm. Yeah, which was exactly about how the Californian... human potential movement made its way into US military intelligence in the 70s and 80s and then sort of morphed and perverted its way into torture techniques at Guantanamo Bay.
For my benefit, what was the human potential movement?
Well, it sort of began at this place called ESLIN, the ESLIN Institute for the Advancement of Human Potential in Big Sur, where they all had naked hot tub encounter sessions, basically, and primal arm wrestling. And all these people came out of that small gang, like Richard Bandler, who invented neuro-linguistic programming, and Est, you know, Werner Erhard, is that his name? Mm-hmm. But also out of this world came Lieutenant Colonel Jim Channon. Oh, Tony Robbins, you know, all these kind of gurus, all came from this kind of small gang of Californians in the late 70s. But in the midst of this was this guy called Lieutenant Colonel Jim Channon, who went to all these places and hung out with all these gurus and became the US Army's New Age guru and inspired Special Forces soldiers to try and kill goats just by staring at them, and, you know, major generals to try and walk through their walls, and Army scientists to invent psychoelectronic weaponry that would, you know, blast your psyche. And a lot of these ideas, you know, really took root and live on. But they live on in the military, they live on in business, they live on in, say, in the Church of England. They seem to have infiltrated their way into all our lives. You know, we're all like the children of the 70s human potential movement, which is fascinating to me because they're all kind of these, you know, nutty megalomaniac, you know, cocaine-fueled, you know, loons. Yet they've had a profound and enormous influence on the fabric of mainstream society, including, you know, everything from Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib to management gurus being brought in to, you know, get cold callers to be more productive.
Specifically with the army, I mean, this does seem at first the most balmy thing, that somebody should suggest using basically new age techniques and things like psychics and remote viewing and things like that. You would have thought the good old, you know, absolutely hardcore rationalist military would have just sort of laughed this off instantly. How on earth did it take hold?
Well, I think that there's a few things. There's the context at the time was that this stuff was taking hold all over the place.
Post-Vietnam.
Yeah, and the other thing, exactly, it was the post-Vietnam funk where everybody was traumatised. You know, the military as a machine was traumatised and looking for something nice. And also, the US military does have this long-standing notion that they shouldn't be afraid to think a long way.
Think the impossible.
Exactly, to be all that they can be. and, you know, they would argue that a lot of very good inventions have come from this way of thinking, like the high visibility jacket. You know, that's a US Army invention.
What's that?
You know, the fluorescent jacket.
Oh, right.
Cyclists wear. The taser gun, which is very controversial, but has saved a lot of lives. You know, I mean, when that was first invented, you know, people thought it was like the kind of Spider-Man neck gun. You know, and it sounded nuts, but that's become, you know, very mainstream. So they'd say, yeah, okay, we never managed to walk through our walls, or, you know, we kept bumping our noses, but, you know, out of this endeavour came the taser gun, you know, came a whole bunch of interrogation techniques that are used at Guantanamo, which they're actually, I think, probably quite proud of, like blasting people with Barney the Purple Dinosaur and stuff like that. You know, they think that's a very good idea.
Which, as you actually say in your book, was actually taken up by a lot of the press in both America and I think in Britain as well, as a kind of comedy story. The dancing poodle at the end of the news story was, you know, they're playing these records to people, but it was torture.
Oh yeah, horrendous. I mean, you know, they'd get these people, stick them in a shipping container in desert heat, blast them for, like, you know, 24, 36 hours with Barney the Purple Dinosaur while flashing a strobe light in their face. You know, they'll have their legs and arms bound, you know, maybe they'd be hanging upside down. But because it was Barney, the I Love You song, you know, everybody, including The Guardian, you know, including my own paper, thought, oh, we all had to listen to Barney at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's not that bad. Yeah, I think we all fell victim to sort of psyop magic trick that we all started thinking, because it was Barney, torture isn't that bad.
But there's a section in the book where you took it to a soldier that was a guard at Abu Ghraib, and he's talking about it being like the haunted hotel in The Shining, and he mentions, quite rightly I think, about, you could say this sort of thing is quite benign now, because obviously when Saddam Hussein was in charge, he was supposedly dissolving people in acid, husbands were watching their wives being raped by gangs of men and things. So I could certainly see why the US Army would be of the opinion that what they're doing is a lot more friendly. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah. Well, they would certainly say that, you know, all these new age techniques that are being used, even if they drive people insane, it's still better than killing people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's their rationale. But it is still torture. But you're right, it's not as bad as being dissolved in acid or crucified, which is what Saddam was doing in that same building. It was a bit creepy when the Abu Ghraib guards saying to me that it's as if the building wanted to be back in business. It's as if they were forced into it. He said it was like, you know, the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. You know, the building was telling them to do this.
It really should be knocked down, shouldn't it?
Yeah,
it's definitely.
It's
a nice thing.
I've lost my train of thought, and it was going to be so interesting.
Well, I'm sure we'll get it back, so I'll try and come up with something else so we were talking about Jim Channon, and who was the first that started this, and tell me about it. I mean, what sort of fellow was he?
He's very canny, Jim. You know, he's got all his kind of robes and his long hair, and, you know, this welcome to my home, you know, come this way to the banyan tree, I invite the wind. But actually, he's an incredibly canny man. You know, he wouldn't be that influential in the army to this day if he wasn't canny.
And that's the amazing thing, that they completely took this seriously. He does come across as just a benign hippie in the documentary, but obviously they took him seriously.
Well, he's back in business, you know, working for Pete Shoemaker, who's the chief of staff of the army. You know, he's been kind of brought back from retirement to train people in his 1st Earth Battalion ways, which is, you know, a lot of it is benign, but, you know, the field of psychoelectronic weaponry and subliminal messages. And the problem with this stuff is, even if it's better than killing people, it still has got this sort of Mengele quality to it, that, you know, in times of crisis, it's okay to treat people like guinea pigs if you're.
Neil and I and the whole rationale of the show is pro science, and this sort of stuff doesn't really do our job for us very well if people are using sort of scientific research to find new ways of torturing people.
Yeah. Well, both a Guantanamo detainee and an Abu Ghraib guard said the same thing to me in the Minister at Goats. They said that the way you should look at these places, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, are like experimental interrogation labs, where all these ideas that have sort of floated around in the dingy world of the theoretical suddenly have a chance to flourish.
Because obviously wars don't come along that often, so they need to...
And when these things do come along, and you see it throughout, you know, the last 20 years of American history, the same thing happens. It's like guinea pigs in the midst of a golden opportunity. That's what the Branch Davidians were at Waco. That's what the Weaver family were at Ruby Ridge. That's what, to a lesser extent, what Noriega was in the Vatican embassy in Panama City. But certainly what, you know, the Guantanamo detainees and the Abu Ghraib detainees are, they're guinea pigs in the midst of a golden opportunity to try stuff out. And I'm not necessarily being kind of critical of it, you know, but I think it's certainly the way you should look at those places, which is why I think people like Seymour Hersh were to an extent, I think they were asking the wrong questions. You know, after the Abu Ghraib torture photographs came out, you know, who gave the orders, how high up does this go? I think that sort of betrays a misunderstanding of how ideas form within the military. You should think of it as like a whole bunch of think tanks all coming together like in a big casserole, each trying to get their elbow room to kind of try stuff out. It's these kind of middle-ranking colonels saying, oh, do you remember that guy, Jim Channon? He used to say we should blast them with music. Let's try that. Oh, do you remember that guy? He said we should stick them all in a big pyramid. Let's try that out. You know, I think that's the way. You know, you saw it happen at Waco. They flew in this Russian scientist called Igor Smirnov, you know, the idea being to blast the Branch Davidians with silent sounds, subliminal sounds. You know, and then there was the Nancy Sinatra lot, then there was this lot and that lot. And it was all, you know, it's like they all had, you know, all trying to get their ideas to the fore, like a casserole of intelligence in an experimental lab.
Sure, Donald Rumsfeld will be pleased that, you know, letting him off the hook there.
Although he's certainly part of it. Yeah, but he said, you know, the reason why Jim Channon's back in the fold was because he said we need to have creative input into the war on terror, which reminds me, you know, kind of, and I don't mean this to sound blithe, but it does remind me a bit of the, you know, of the way Hitler would operate, which was basically, you know, we need to kind of come up with a way to do this, and then it all, you know, all his kind of minions would scuttle around trying to come up with ideas. And that's, you know, what Rumsfeld would say, you know, we need to think of more creative ideas, and then it all scuttle around thinking, you know, trying to please him with creative ideas, you know, like musical torture. Good example.
There's a bit near towards the end of The Men of Stare at Goats, and the whole book actually has an interesting trajectory, because it starts off quite light-hearted. Oh, look at these sort of weird hippies in the army, and it gets progressively darker really as you head towards Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. And there's this extraordinary story that you hear from the British released prisoner, I forget his name now.
Jamal Al-Harith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he tells this bizarre story about somebody bringing in a ghetto blaster and playing him something like...
Chris Christopherson and Fleetwood Mac at normal volume.
Yeah.
And then...
And just leaving it on there, leaving it in his cell.
Yeah. Well, they took him to an interrogation cell and they'd stick on Chris Christopherson the whole CD...
So it wasn't even a repetitive Barney the Dinosaur over and over. And
it wasn't being blasted either. And it wasn't sort of, you know, you know, it wasn't sort of screechy sounds. And then when that was over, they sort of put it on again to the beginning and then left the room again. And this would go on for, you know, hours and hours and hours.
It wasn't them just trying to change his taste in music.
No, I mean,
good old American.
Yeah, you can't say that it was him, them trying to freak him out, you know, with Western culture, because, you know, Jamal's from Manchester. You can't say that they were trying to sort of blast him on a psychic level, because it was normal volume. So he swears they weren't doing it like to entertain him. He says, really, the atmosphere wasn't that. Well, I came to a theory anyway, which was, you know, what we know they tried at Waco, because it's been declassified, which is subliminal sounds, which is, you know, underneath Chris Christopherson is, you know,
backwards voice or something,
backmasking
or something, yeah.
Which sounds, you know, sort of freaky, but when you think about it, it's just a psyop soldier in a radio studio much like this one in Fort Bragg. And I went into the radio studios at Fort Bragg, and they do look much like this one. Just whispering into a microphone, you know, tell us what you know. and then you lace it into Chris Christopherson, and then, you know, see if it works.
You've not noticed the subliminal sounds emanating from this studio yet?
Well, I don't think both coming from outside.
Right, but the rationalist in me thinks it's just an air vent.
There's, on the same track as what Richard just described, there's a couple of incidents in both books, that really stood out for me. You know, I'm reading the book Them, and it is a nice... portrait of you know, wacky conspiracy theorists. And then there's the chapter about Ruby Ridge, and in The Menester It Goes, the trajectory takes us towards the end where you tell the MK Ultra story. And both of these seem to me, you know, you describe it as this idea that this is the point where the nutty conspiracy theorists and the nutty government do actually intersect, and this thing does happen.
Yeah, these are both places where the conspiracy theories come true. Certainly, and where your sympathy lies, you know, entirely with, well, certainly in the case of Ruby Ridge, your sympathies lie entirely with the Nazis, basically, you know, which is, you know,
which is an unusual, yeah, place,
which is
to
very
find
odd.
Yourself in.
I know, very odd, but true. You know, and in many ways, it was just the worst. I mean, for that reason, it's the worst thing that the government could have done, because, you know, they turned the weavers into heroes, and there's a
right into their hands.
Yeah, and you know, the Oklahoma City bombing was. I mean, there was you know, McVeigh said there were three things that inspired him to do that: the first Gulf War, Waco, and Ruby Ridge. I mean, you know, McVeigh took the same journey I took, which was, you know, up to the cabin. I should probably explain for listeners who don't know. It was a family of, they weren't white supremacists, they were white separatists, which in that world, you know, is very, you know, they say it's a very different thing. You know, they thought the New World Order was going to get them, so they moved up to a cabin at the top of the mountain in Idaho, quite near the golf course. You know, there's nowhere in America is that far away from civilization. And they got all paranoid in there, you know, the Bilderberg group are going to get us. They're watching us from the bushes. And they were watching them from the bushes. You know, the ATF and the US Marshals sent an undercover agent to get Randy Weaver to become an informant for them and spy on the nearby Nazis. And he said no, so they entrapped him into sawing off a shotgun slightly below the legal limit, and they say, now you have to become an informant for us, you know, because otherwise we're going to get you on a gun charge. And Randy said, no way, and he sort of shut himself in the cabin. And what you had then, it was like, you know, like I said earlier about, you know, David Icke, he had a sort of spiral of nuttiness on both sides. Inside the cabin, the weavers became convinced that they were watching them from the bushes, and the people in the bushes watching them became convinced that the Weaver family, this, you know, basically sweet, nutty little family with these little baby kids running around, were like, you know, the USSR.
Yeah, massing some...
Yeah, with weapons. You know, landmines, and it was a compound suddenly. It wasn't a cabin anymore, it was a compound, and they were like the greatest, you know, enemy America faced. And, you know, when you've got that much paranoia on both sides, it's going to explode. And it exploded with the FBI and the ATF, you know, killing the little boy, Sammy Weaver, and then killing Vicky Weaver, you know, who was unarmed. She was just holding a baby, and they killed her. They killed the dog. And and it gave birth to the militia movement and to Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, I mean, it was grotesque, and it had, in every way, it was the wrong way of dealing with anything.
Absolutely.
Really.
Plus, I mean, it was so interesting. I mean, I hung around quite a long time with Rachel Weaver, one of the daughters, and, you know, you just couldn't meet a lovelier, more intelligent, you know, nice person.
Nice
and, yeah, and well, that was the downside. I had a bit of a crush on her, actually, and I thought to myself, you know, if I wasn't married and if Rachel didn't believe that, you know, the Jews were the mud people, maybe.
Just a couple of barriers there.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to talk a bit more about this sort of conspiracy theory, because it is something that worries me enormously, in that, you know, we've talked a little bit about it. It isn't just, you know, your neo-Nazis who believe this. It's a lot of... it's now starting to be people on the left. And people like Icke are happy to... Their website, you know, if you look at Icke's website, for example, you don't really get the nutty stuff at first. You just get this sort of the standard
good youth culture,
anti-Bush, anti-war, anti-pollution... good stuff, you know, nice and inviting, and it's only, you know, you actually have to go into it quite a way before you find stuff about the lizards out.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I think it's a little bit dangerous, I've got to say. I mean, I think as a Jew, I find it a bit dangerous, because I think that, you know, there is anti-Semitism laced into a lot of these conspiracy theories. You know, it annoys me a bit when, you know, a sort of anti-Israel feeling gets so mashed up with anti-Semitism. Which seems to happen a lot. I mean, a lot of Jews I know, you know, have sort of stopped reading The Guardian because they think it's crossed the line from anti-Zionist to anti-Semitic. I work for them and I'm Jewish. And so do lots of other Jews work for them because we control the media.
The comment editor has certainly taken the commentary in the Guardian into interesting areas recently.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there is, you know, this stuff is getting laced into, you know, the left thinking.
I'm wondering what we can do to counter. I don't know why I'm asking you specifically, John, you've investigated it to an extent, and you've seen the sort of wide variety that there is of conspiracy theories.
The problem with the left at the moment is polemicism. There's too much polemicism on the left. This is the problem. Because polemicists, you know, by the very nature of polemicism, lie. You know, polemics is all about lying. It's all about cutting out the stuff that doesn't fit your agenda. You know, Michael Moore does it. You know, every leading left-wing commentator I can think of does it, including some, you know, good personal friends of mine. I find it to be, you know, a slightly sort of dangerous way of doing things, because it turns everything black and white, and you know, we liberals are always quite good at, you know, not being black and white.
And it's also, yeah, it's trying to make things simple that aren't simple.
Yeah.
The fact is that, you know, the world is quite complicated, I think, and sometimes to try and just, as you're saying, it's all, there are bad people over there and there are good people over here.
Yeah.
That's basically heading towards the conspiracy theories.
So. Yeah, I mean, I happen to think that the Bushes are basically all bad, and it's very hard to find anything good with the Bushes. But, you know, I don't believe the stuff in Fahrenheit 9/11. I don't believe, you know, the Bush-Saudi connection. I don't believe that Bush, you know, knew 9/11 was going to happen, which is basically what Michael Moore was trying to make us think in that.
There's a fascinating scene where we're introduced to the Iraq war, and he presents this scene of children in a park with flying kites and stuff, and it's
lovely.
Would have been proud of that sequence.
I know, it's
shocking.
It's absolutely shocking, you know, that, you know, before the Americans invaded Iraq, all the Iraqis ever did was slide down slides.
yeah.
I know, it's crazy. I wish, you know, there were more people on the left who you know, dealt in shades of grey. Yeah, because we tend not to. And it's partly a response of being the oppressed minority, you know, being the outsider now, you know, now that, you know, the kind of right-wing nuts are in power.
But certainly, in politics, so many things seem to be... All, the behaviour of America always seems to be down to... Well, they're obviously doing it because of Israel. They're doing it to protect Israel. It doesn't matter what it is or where in the world it is, Israel is always involved some way.
Yeah. And Israel's got a lot to answer for. I mean, you know, but... again, it's not like... it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because
it's still becoming obvious. It's just another conspiracy theory, isn't it? It's an easy sort of trope to bring out.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly wish that, you know, Israel was a bit sweeter. But, you know...
all of our jobs easy.
I know, it certainly would. But, you know, I mean, I don't believe... Well, we know for certain that, you know, Bin Laden's philosophy has really got nothing to do with Israel. You know, it's to do with the American presence in Saudi Arabia. So.
But on a wide, you know, it has got something to do with Israel on a wider scale, which is that it wants it wiped off the face of the earth, and that's something that obviously you can't bargain with. You know, you're not going to get.
And it's also something that's not going to happen. Indeed. You know. And so, you know, so it's partly the Palestinians' fault too. I mean, I do think that. Oh God, my history has eluded me in the heat of the moment.
Well, we're going
down. Arafat's, you know, sort of refusal to sign the Clinton-Begin peace accord, which actually would have created a perfectly good Palestinian state, because, you know, he wanted to put in that clause that meant that Israel would be wiped off the face of the earth. You know, I mean, there have been times when you know we nearly had a proper peace in that region. And it wasn't just the Israelis' fault, but we are getting sidetracked.
If we can go back to, I have to raise the General Stubblebine trying to walk through the walls, because I think it's such a lovely image, because it does seem, I mean, it seems so reasonable, actually. You know, this idea that, you know, an atom is, they compare an atom to, you know, Winchester Cathedral with a fly in it or something.
Talking to Simon Singh last week, and he was talking about this sort of thing.
Right.
And it seems so reasonable, but...
He said that the atom is made up mostly of space, and the wall and the human body are made up mostly of atoms. So it is possible to merge the spaces, and you can walk through your wall. But of course, you know, the key word in this is mostly. The atom is only made up mostly of space. You know, there is some solid matter in there.
You do think, it does seem like a reasonable proposition, but then why am I not falling through this chair?
Exactly. You know, you just
pulled towards the centre of the earth.
Yeah. So in a way, it's lucky that it didn't work, because exactly, he would have fallen through to the basement, wouldn't he? If he'd managed to master the technique, he would have got all the way to Australia.
If you got sidetracked halfway through, would you sort of be stuck
halfway
through a wall, and sort of the same thing I always used to worry about in Star Trek when they did the beaming down?
Yeah.
Hit walls, or they never landed 5 foot above the ground.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's more than I found out, by the way, about the wall walking. General Stubblebine, I'm sure, was not the only leading American military man to attempt to walk through his wall. I'm certain that there were teams of special forces soldiers at Fort Bragg who were all jogging. All jogging towards their walls and then bumping their noses.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes, so I think...
My slightly offensive diversion saying that Israel was, you know, utterly innocent and entire Palestinian.
That'll go down well.
Glad to have given you a voice.
If I could live over the last, if I could relive the last 2 minutes, I probably wouldn't have gone down that road. So.
We're quite glad you did. It'll be on the website tomorrow. I had a totally unconnected with any of our usual topics, so I just wondered what, because I know you mentioned that you were looking forward to it. What did you think of the Dylan documentary on TV?
Oh, that was fantastic, wasn't it? Amazing to see. Although I sort of sighed slightly with the guy who shouted Judas.
Well, it's Mike Ben Forty shouted Judith.
Judith. My son said to me, my 7-year-old said, you know, after I don't believe you, you're a liar. He said, that's not funny. So it could have been, he could have had a bit. But no, I thought it was brilliant.
I was just astonished that this footage existed of the Manchester
after
gig.
Those years,
yeah,
I know.
That was absolutely astonishing.
Absolutely incredible. I mean, the footage from Newcastle, which they used earlier on, you know, that beautiful red curtain, you know, that they used at the beginning of the film with Lacroix, it's absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah, but the reason why I sighed slightly with the Judas people is that you can tell from the footage that you know, because this music came before the sort of advent of decent speakers and decent mixing desks, it, you know, probably sounded terrible if you were sitting in the hall.
It's extremely loud, even by today's standards. They brought their own PA over. Anyway, I'm sidetracking into one of my favourite areas.
Talk about that film. But it was beautifully made. I mean, what a brilliant documentary.
Yeah, it was nice.
Although he does seem to think that Dylan, you know, basically died in that motorcycle accident, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah. I mean, the rest of his career, you know, Desire and Blonde on Blonde are all sort of relegated to a short Aston at the end of the documentary. But that's a small criticism for what was basically a completely brilliant documentary, I thought.
Well, perhaps we'll have to bring you back to talk about the documentary over an hour.
Yeah, my Dylanology.
John
Thank
Ronson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming in. You can visit our website, which is www.littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.